Hello and welcome. This is D. Garrett Nadeau presenting one of a number of podcasts on behalf of the Lancashire Authors Association. The purpose of these podcasts is to discuss writers and various writing topics with an emphasis on Lancashire writing and writers, but including a broad range of subjects from all over England and regular musical interludes to vary your listening experience. My guest for this podcast is John Winstanley.
Hello.
Hi, John. Thank you for joining us. John's written a book, and it's called Unsigned Unseen, which we'll be talking about a little bit later. First of all, though, John, can you tell us a little bit about your background, about where you grew up and where you were born, all that sort of stuff?
I was born in Okehampton in Devon in 1962. Okay. I'm 53 years young this year.
Right.
Didn't really live very long in Okehampton. About second birthday, we moved to near Bridgewater in Somerset. Then I moved to Lancashire because my parents were originally from the north. And since about the age of 7, 8 years old, I've lived in Exton, near Chorley. Now I've settled down with my wife and family in Withnal, and I've been there since 1993. I work in Manchester for a financial institution. Two daughters, now 19 and 22.
Right. The book that you've written, though, is about the music industry, in particularly about Chorley. So obviously, there must be some background sort of going back to your youth that influenced you, particularly in terms of music. When do you first remember being introduced to music and getting interested in it? And
chapter one is my personal journey.
Right.
Which a lot of people can probably relate to, because as we grow up, we hear music. My father was a professional musician. And he used to play organ in the working men's clubs and cabaret circuits.
Right, okay.
So I had that exposure for him practicing, and sometimes he'd have people around to rehearse.
Yeah.
Because he played in a duo or a trio, depending on what the work demanded during the 60s. My mother listened to the radio. She liked to dance. So as a little boy and, you know, as an infant, there would be music in the house. As I grew older, of course, your friends like music at school. We used to listen to the radio in our break time. I remember listening to Radio 1, Noel Edmonds, when I was at school in Leyland at Balshaws, 13, 14. And of course, the big explosion in terms of music of my generation was punk and new wave music. Some people got into Northern Soul, which was popular during the sort of early to mid-70s as well. In the north of England, and in Lancashire in particular, Wigan being the world centre for Northern Soul, as well as Blackpool and a few other notable clubs, Stoke and places like that. So music's always been there, but what really happened that put me into this 5-year period of music was going and meeting somebody in a bar one night who gave me a fanzine. And he said, if you ever want to write for this, we were there to watch a tribute band to the Sex Pistols and the Ramones. And I thought about this the following day. There was a tribute band to The Jam, which was a band I saw a couple of times before they split up, which was Paul Weller's original band. And I thought, well, why not? I'll go and interview these guys, see what they're about and why they do what they do and how close to the original it is. I interviewed them, took a few photographs, typed out a report, sent it to Roy. A couple of weeks later, pops through my door, black and white copy, and there was my name in print with this feature and this interview and my pictures. And I just thought, this is great. It was like an awakening. It was like an epiphany.
So that's how you got into writing, really.
It was two things. The music side and the writing came together. And that fanzine that we produced together for about 3 years was the go-to magazine for what was happening in the area, particularly around Blackburn and Preston and most of Lancashire.
What about school, though? Did you study writing in school or English? I mean, you must have done some English. Obviously, everybody does some English. But was that an area that was of a particular interest to you? And what further education did you do? Did you go on, like, to university? And
I followed the normal co-educational system at primary school. And I always remember the first book that somebody wrote, that somebody read to me, which I say, well, that was the first book I read, because somebody read it to me. Must have been probably 4 or 5 years old. And Mrs. Donovan in Lavington, the school I was at, read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
Right.
But I never really got into books in a big way. I mean, a lot of boys and girls that I knew really were avid readers, but I wasn't. I didn't really have any interest.
So was maths and science more your interest than
sports?
Sports. Sports was your interest.
Yeah.
And did you play? Did you play? You played sports then?
I liked sports. Football, cricket, rugby. But I also was a typical boy, used to get into fights, used to like swapping football cards, you know, that used to come with bubblegum things and all the things that boys do really, and, you know, get into mischief, etc. But I suppose the discipline for writing and the appreciation of literature really happened when you got to a point where you were studying for your O-levels. So we had to study Shakespeare and certain books that were on the curriculum, and then you took an exam. But the interest in that, when I went to college, Runcher College in Leyland for 2 years, English literature was one of the subjects I studied.
Right,
and I was inspired by a teacher called Helen Tozer, who was our English literature teacher, but she also did drama as well. So in the lunchtime, I joined the drama group and started doing plays. Okay. So I got an appreciation of playwriting. And from there, I was asked to join St. Ambrose Players in Leyland. So I did a couple of plays with them.
All right.
And then I went to Preston Musical Comedy, did some musicals like Fiddler on the Roof, Sweet Charity for another splinter group. And Preston Drama Club asked me to do some stuff. So the writing and the appreciation of literature went hand in hand with acting.
And
performing, shall we say. So
This book didn't just appear out of the wilderness. This is kind of developed over a period of time. It seems to me that because of that experience in the drama and the literature and that interest in reading was kind of in the background. Because you obviously weren't employed, you didn't become, what was your first job? Where did you work after?
I suppose my very first job was an assistant chef at a cafe in Chorley called the Copper Kettle. Okay. So that was like
quite creative as well, I suppose. So there's a creative link to all of these. Tenuous, perhaps,
And then I got asked because my father tried to teach me piano, but I wasn't very good. I wasn't very talented. My mother paid for piano lessons at boarding school in St. Anne's. And my first job really was being asked to play drums in a working men's club, Chorley Labour Club, in Friday Street, which is now a health club. It's gone, as a working men's club. Like a lot of the working men's clubs, like the Bamber Bridge Trades Hall, I used to play there. I think that might still be going and St. Mary's in Exton, and when the Falklands War was on, I used to do a lot of benefit gigs as well for raising money for the heroes.
So presumably you were in a band.
It was mainly a typical working men's club. You had an organ and a drummer, an organist and a drummer.
And then you'd
have turns, as they used to call them. So, you know, Fred Bloggs, you know, plumber by day would be Elvis Presley and, you know, or Matt Monro at night sort of thing. So he would come down with his dots, as he used to call them, for the organist. And they were normally like the standard classics like Sweet Caroline and Is This the Way to Amarillo and all that sort of thing. And it's something I talk about in chapter two, really, that sort of lineage of something that doesn't really exist now. The working men clubs culture, in England is long since gone. But, that was the musical appreciation. And that was probably my first real job because I used to play, for the artists on a Friday and Saturday on a Saturday and a Sunday, and Fridays was just dancing. And something else I talk about was ballroom dancing. And that's what my mum used to push me around the floors, cause she used to like dancing. So in time, I was able to push her around doing old time music hall dancing and as well as, modern, dancing as well, like cha-cha-cha and all that sort of thing.
Obviously you decided not to continue to do that because you didn't become. You haven't been a drummer all your life.
No,
so
I realized
what was the change? When did you?
It was hand in hand with joining my day job, which I started at 18 in Preston, working for a bank. Hence, there's a parental advisory sticker at the front because bank is a four-letter word. So that's something that catches people's eye. Plus the fact that it is littered with quite a lot of four-letter words. I must advise readers that if they're thinking of buying it for the children, then parental advisory, because it talks, and there are interviews with a lot of people who do use a lot of four letter words. But, that really, sorry to get back on track, is the career that I took up, knowing that I really didn't have, I suppose, the time and the patience to do it professionally. It's like most things, you go through a phase, and I reached a natural conclusion, just like acting reached a natural conclusion. The drumming by about 2021, that was over. I'd decided that I would move on and do something else. Right. Which by that time was in Barrow-in-Furness.
Okay.
Got transferred up there, and of course that's where I met my wife, which I talk about in the book, and that, you know, obviously is another adventure that we're still on 26 years later.
Right, okay, we'll talk about that in a minute, but maybe time for a little bit of music now, so we'll have a listen to...
Well, the first track I thought I'd ask you to play is Claws of My Heart, which is by a new guitar vocalist to me that I saw during something that Nigel Stewart puts together and the creative network at the Leyland Live recently. His name's called Dean Lane. And Claws of My Heart, I think it's called, is about people who smoke and why they shouldn't smoke. But it's also a message to other people that, you know, just be careful what you do in life. And Dean is a really nice guy. You know, I've met him, I've met his partner as well, Hannah. And I think I'd like to, you know, champion somebody, because the book is all about the unsung heroes, the local people who never really make the big time.
Okay, let's have a listen to that then.
Don't stand the way you stand as your cigarette glides to your mouth from your hand. It sends claws to the cage and puts years on your age, and it shows you're not long for this land.
John, that was really interesting listening to that. Can I just, before we go on a little bit, I want to talk about this four-letter word thing, because I think it's an issue with writers that sometimes people stumble over, because it is difficult to decide sometimes whether to include, because if you want to include in your audience a certain age group, then it's inappropriate sometimes, you think in your head, to use those four-letter words. But obviously you've decided that your audience, you want your audience to be, can we say an adult audience?
Yeah, mature teenage audience.
And you decided to use those words because that's how people talk.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're kind of a realist in terms of your writing. I mean, the book that you've written is, would you say it's nitty gritty? Is it sort of down to earth? It's down to earth, kind of like a book that's kind of tells it like it is.
It features interviews with famous people like Glenn Matlock, the bass player with the Sex Pistols, that did his first ever acoustic gig at the North Bar in Blackburn in January 2003. That covers chapter 3, basically. Well, of course, Glenn and the Sex Pistols were known for using the first sort of four-letter word on the Grundy show, and that sort of catapulted them into the spotlight. So you can't censor something like that. And also other interviews that you've got there with, like, Pretend Girlfriend from Paddy and Burnley, who I managed for the best part of 3 years and still retain very close links with the band. And Sean Maxwell from Chorley, the Penniless Playboy, who's been writing and recording music for 40 years. So they are genius songwriters that live their life through their songs, and their life is, you know, at times crude, and four-letter words are what they use. So it is a non-fiction book. It is an autobiographical book of my life and a biography of other people as well.
You mentioned the Sex Pistols. Now, most people know the Sex Pistols, but there are groups in here that, you know, that didn't make the grade, if you will, or didn't make it to that being well known. Have you got a theory about who makes it and who doesn't make it? Is it down to luck, or is it hard work, or
what's the difference between the book is all about?
Okay.
The last two chapters really nail it, because I used to watch Pop Idol and Fame Academy, which are the forerunners of what we now have today as Britain Got Talent and The X Factor.
Yeah.
And we've always had talent shows. If you go back to Opportunity Knocks,
yes, of course,
New Faces, etc. But it wasn't until I had this baptism of fire and this wonderful experience for 5 years that I can talk authoritatively about what works and what doesn't work. Why Joe Nobody and Mary Dipstick don't make it is because of what I talk about in chapter, in the final chapter. So as you read the book, you're picking up me stumbling through this whole promotion, band, being a DJ on radio for Chorley FM, you know, being an agent for booking, setting up a record label, doing videos, all this sort of thing. And then when you actually look back and reflect on the book and the 300 and odd pages that are there, chapter 12 makes absolute sense. Because it then nails and answers your question. So people buying the book, either downloading it as an ebook from Amazon or going into Waterstones to buy it in Preston where it's a bestseller, they can go and read that chapter and know exactly what makes people work and why they don't.
There are two aspects to your book, aren't there? There's your personal life and your personal journey, and then there's the music side, the Chorley. How much research did you have to do? Let's just talk about the music side, because that's where we're on at the moment. We'll come back to your personal life in a bit. But how much research did you feel you had to do? Was it based on just, you know, going around to gigs and the time that you spent meeting these people casually before you ever decided to write the book? Or after you decided to write it, did you rush around and sort of meet people? Or how did you go about
that? That's a really good question, because when you read the chapters, you'll understand that I was an enthusiastic amateur.
Right.
I was stumbling around not really knowing what to do, other than I needed to get out. I needed to understand what was going on in my own doorstep. And you started talking to somebody in a pub one day, next minute I'm writing for a fanzine, next minute I'm interviewing people, then I'm talking to Glenn Matlock. How did that happen? And within 6 months, the first three or four chapters really just join up all those dots. At the end, the original reason why I wrote a book is that I was going to be made redundant. There were three disasters happening in my life: redundancy, turning 40, and also a more serious one, which was my mother was dying of cancer. So within a very short space of time, that led to a huge explosion of disasters in my life. So out of that, I said to my wife, look, I'm going to take redundancy. I'm going to take a year off work. I'm 40. I might never get this chance again. And I think most men and most women at certain ages reach a crossroads and think, well, is this all there is? Because I've worked for one employer for over 20 years. And I climbed the ladder of a career in banking. And I was quite grateful for that. But I just thought there must be something more in life. My children were sort of 8 and 9 at the time as well. And I thought, if I don't do it
Would midlife crisis be too much of a cliche?
Well, that's what it is.
Or was it?
It was. The difference was, instead of chasing women and fast cars, I said, I'd like to, you know, get involved in writing and seeing where this music thing takes me. And she said, well, better that than the alternative. So, that's what took me on that journey. And after a year, I was ready to stop and finish. She said, no, you're managing this young band from Chorley called Let's Not Lose Master of the Comedies. Those lads adore you. Keep going. And then I sort of, after 4 years later.
Are you generally a risk taker? Do you think of yourself as taking lots of risks in life?
I work for a bank. I was disciplined not to take risks.
Yeah.
Although you could say that's another story in terms of where the bank went wrong and the catastrophe we had, 5 or 6 years ago. I was brought in just in the old school way. I qualified under the Associated Chartered Institute of Banks. I took my professional exam. So I was disciplined not to take risks.
Right.
But there I was. And I suppose looking back now, conversation I was having with Peter before, it's about depression as well. I went through a period of depression not knowing it, Classic symptoms of post-traumatic stress. You go and take redundancy, your mother's died, you were very close to your mother because my father left when I was 11. So she brought me up single-handedly and held down 3 jobs, to keep me at boarding school. And then, when I didn't qualify to go to Arnold College, I went back into the grammar school or the ex-grammar school that Balshaw's was. So I had a lot of gratitude and a lot of understanding of not taking risks. And then to go on this journey and take all these, I wouldn't say risks, but applying what I'd learned in my day job to helping people who didn't seem to be getting on. Why did Mary Dipstick not become famous even though she was really talented? The art of writing though and the research, which the original question, I always kept meticulous records of what I was doing. I had boxes and boxes of gig flyers, of notes, diaries, et cetera, et cetera. And 500 bands are listed in the back where I've got letters from them or CDs or copies of videos. And it might be just invites to gigs or whatever. But I kept all this. And then I thought, right, after 5 years, I'll sit down and that's it. I'll start writing. And it didn't happen straight away. I took 6 months off.
Yeah.
And then I thought, what do I write about? What would people be interested in? So the first conversation I had was with Sean Maxwell. And he said, well, why not tell my story? So The Penniless Playboy, which is chapter 9, is Sean's story. And in writing that story at the very beginning, I developed my style because Sean would take me away and say, right, these 5 pages you sent me, John, we can cut those down to 5 lines. And this line that you put in, that actually has to be a paragraph or a couple of pages. It was really important.
So he helped you structure the book, really.
Yeah. And that's where you learned that
structure is important to writing. I mean, some things need expanding and some things need to be cut or edited.
It's the discipline, isn't it?
It is. You can
either go on courses and learn it or you can do what I did and take your time. Life intervened as well. It wasn't just a question. I started off on one day and then 5 years later it was, I have to put this down and I had to look after an uncle who was dying. I had to go into a home and he lived over on, in Birkenhead. So there was quite a lot of journeys backwards and forwards to Birkenhead. The kids are growing up, of course, and I stopped doing the music to concentrate on them as well because they were teenagers by this stage and with all the issues that that brings as well. So that was my focus. I suppose to keep a family, a marriage, and 2 dogs and everything else.
Were you
else
able
together.
To develop a writing routine? I mean, did you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and write before everybody got up? Or
I have more of a routine now than I ever have when it comes to writing and the commitments to Lancashire Authors as the secretary and Chorley District Writers Group and member of that committee and all the other things that I've got. But the actual structure of a non-fiction book may be easier to write because I've never written any fiction, although I've started to dabble now with being in part of these writing groups. And it helped by having little sections, the period with managing this band or the period that I was a DJ on Chorley FM or the period, I ran a business. And different people can take different things from those periods, which then became the chapters. Yeah.
So your structure is pretty much chronological then?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think we've got time for another tune, and we'll come back to that after we hear your next song.
Well, I thought I'd introduce a woman singer here called Roberta Flack, who sang a Ewan McCall song, which is called The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face.
Face. your face, your face, your face.
All right, John, tell us a little bit about why you chose that Roberta Flack song.
The title, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, rather than The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, it is the emphasis on ever. And because the song was written by Ewan McCall, who was a very hardline socialist thinker, who wrote Dirty Old Town, for example, and his daughter was Kirsty McCall. So a lot of people think that's a love song between a man and a woman. And the cleverness of that is it is to a lot of people. But because of Ewan McCall and his socialist beliefs, I believe that's a song, is a homage to socialism. The first time ever I saw your face, the first time I read your words, the first time, you know, I kissed your lips, the first time I spoke your words, the first time I lay with you, the first time I stood shoulder to shoulder with my comrade, my brother, and embraced socialism. It's just a different twist. Nobody said, well, that's definitely not wrong, and I've never met Ewan McCall. Yeah. Yeah. Any of his family say, well, no, you know, it was definitely a love song. But it's the thing about books and poetry, isn't it? We could read the same book and have or a poem and have a completely different slant.
I don't usually talk about politics. Well, I haven't yet. But I just wanted to ask a little bit about, because it seems to me that the groups, the musical groups that you talk about, and this whole punk thing, there's a kind of a revolutionary aspect to that. Like we're defying authority, a kind of a defiance, which I went through myself in the 60s. But can I just ask you, do you consider yourself to be a socialist then? Are you, is that personally where you?
It's a good question. The politics I subscribe to are those of Gerard Winstanley. And for people who don't know Gerard Winstanley, he was, a socialist thinker who had his name inscribed on the obelisk in Russia after the revolution, along with other, socialist thinkers. And the reason why that happened was because he wrote a series of pamphlets just after King Charles I was executed. And he put his words into action by leading a band of people to Cobham Hill in Surrey to declare the land as the common land for the people of England. Because during the Civil War, the landed gentry have been encroaching on the common land. And this is land where people had the right to go to graze the cattle, to collect firewood and dig clay and that sort of thing. So Gerard Winstanley, the Diggers of 1649, was an actual historical thing that happened in England by this person who believed that the world was a common treasury. No man had any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain, which is a line that Leo Rossenden put in his song called World Turned Upside Down, which was a song that Billy Bragg covered as well on the B-side of Levi Strauss, which is my introduction to it. And often, as my name is Winstanley, I was always curious, how many famous Winstanleys are there in the world? Yeah. And there was a little tiny footnote in this history book, Gerard Winstanley and the Digger Movement of 1649. Well, what was all that about? And there was very little that was written about him. So I did a bit of research, but the books really didn't sing him as a hero in the same way that we see Guy Fawkes as some sort of hero. But he was an anarchist, and he wanted to blow up the king. Gerard Winstanley was a pacifist who was standing up for the common people of England that were enslaved in this culture of the squire and the lord, and everybody who worked for him was tied to the land and had to live on and pay rents and things like that.
Would you say there was a conflict in your life between that awareness and that sensitivity and the job that you did, the financial? Because there's the people tend to think that the financiers and people on that side are very conservative, kind of stuffy, kind of like no-nonsense sort of people who don't put up with all this socialism nonsense there. Capitalists all the way, etc. People tend to kind of think there's a dividing line between these financiers and the socialist movement. But you obviously would, I'm assuming that you would say that's not necessarily true, or?
Isn't it like you judge a book by its cover? You judge people by the jobs that they do.
Yeah, but
we shouldn't, because we do subconsciously say, he's accountants are stuffy and boring people,
or, absolutely.
you know.
Well, I was in the computer industry for 20 years, and I'm not a computer nerd by any means.
Well, exactly. And that's the problem, that people think, oh, he works for a bank and he'll be quite stuffy and reserved, et cetera, et cetera. And that isn't the case, because I don't let my job or what I do define me. And the emphasis on things like the digger movement, how I got involved in the festival that's now put on every year, that this year it's on the 12th of September in Wigan Town Centre at the Weend, which is right in the centre of Wigan. It's a free festival. I've met people from all political persuasions, but they put all their politics at the door, and we have a committee meeting, and we discuss how we're going to put the festival on. But in terms of banking and that side of it, and it is something I talk about in the book, because in fact, Gerard Winstanley came from a successful family of cloth merchants, and they were quite middle class. And his job down in London was trying to look after the London office. But during the war, trade suffered dramatically, and he was a failed businessman.
Right.
And rather like me, I'd got to a period in my life, having been in banking for 20 years. And I said, you know, earlier on, that I was at a crossroads, like he was. I was turning 40, like he was. And I'm wondering, is this it? So, because he then went back and looked at what happened in Wigan and how they managed to create a piece of legislation that actually was approved by the king, whereby common people in 1618 in Wigan were able to dig the wastes, as they call them, the wastelands of Wigan, for clay and collect firewood. And that really started to break down the hierarchical structure that existed. And there's a piece of work that Derek Winstanley did that I presented at last year's festival, which was 98% of Derek's words about that historical thing. So if people are coming to Wigan on the 12th of September this year, I hope to be able to do that presentation again, as well as doing the arts and culture tents that we're looking to establish, and all the music that goes on. It's a fantastic thing that goes on there.
Yeah.
So, it is something that you then turn to your passion that drove your teenage years. And I think a lot of people go back, what is it that fired Gerard Winstanley up? It's that thing that happened when he was in his sort of early teens in Wigan, and he saw the results of that. And I saw what punk did. A lot of people think it was about swearing, it was violent, etc. But it was about taking things not for granted. That to be a successful musician, you had to have a record deal. You know, all the pomps and circumstances of prog rock and the bloated way the music system was took the music away from people. And the Sex Pistols and a lot of that punk band said, no, you don't need to do it. Here's three chords, go and write a song. If you want to know how to set a record label up, the Buzzcocks, with their Spiral Scratch EP, they set their own record label, which then became New Harmonies. They put their own gig on. They invited the Sex Pistols to play. Next minute, Tony Wilson sees them. They're on television. And there was a revolution that went on. Who was it who created one of the most successful charitable events in our lifetime? It was the descendants of punk. It was Bono and Bob Geldof. And it was that, we won't take things for granted. We won't accept what it is. We will do something about it. Well, you talking about America, the Asprey movement. You know, the Hate Asprey, things that were going on there. The Hate Asprey movement, was curious because they actually related back to the diggers and didn't understand the actual digging was the physical digging. They just did it because they dug it, man, you know, and that was quite an interesting thing. But they had soup kitchens. They used to collect the, leftovers, the food that was going rotten, and then they would, have these, free come along and take this food, homeless people, et cetera, giving something back. So that culture and that undercurrent of people of every generation, there will be people like the Sex Pistols. You know, you had it with Nirvana from America. They inspired kids as well. The Smiths did it over here. And every generation will have that.
Would you say that's
change the status quo?
Music led? Is there
it's culture
a
led.
Music?
It's fashion, music.
Right.
Writing can do it as well. Certain books will come out and change people's views. 1984, you know, George Orwell, you know, things that were going on, Ernest Hemingway, you know, the Spanish Civil War. It's culture, it's art. That's what stimulates changes and people to change their attitude, their acceptance of the status quo, using their imagination. And of course, technology drives it as well. I mean, we noticed that in the music industry with the, what was the forerunner of Facebook, things like MySpace, for example, which is where bands could put their music on a computer that anybody, anywhere in the world could actually listen to rather than have to send plastic discs in envelopes to people. So that really moved very quickly. And the biggest upsurge that that created was the Arctic Monkeys, who are now one of the leading English bands.
If I can just change direction quite severely just for a minute, because you mentioned earlier about your depression.
Yes.
And I wanted to sort of talk about that a little bit more, if you don't mind, if you're able to talk about that, because we also talked about judging books by their covers. And I think that people do, my feeling is, because I've had some experience of it myself, and I know a lot of people who've had, and obviously I don't think I was as severe an experience as you've had, but people don't understand it. They don't really, what people think depression is something like, oh, pull your socks up and get over it and have a good sleep or have a drink and sort of get on with it and sort of, watch something funny and you'll be better
cheer
again.
Up. Pull
cheer up.
Together.
Yeah. People think that depression is something that you should be able to be, yourself should be able to get over and get through. But I don't think that real depression, severe depression, is like that. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience so that people can understand what you went through?
I was diagnosed with having reactive depression at the end of January last year. And my doctor says, you will now have to take 5 or 6 months off work. And I said, whoa.
Wow.
So I can't take I could take 5 or 6 weeks maybe. And one of the things they asked me to do was do something that wasn't connected with work that I enjoyed. And he asked what I enjoyed and said music. And in fact, I've been writing, he said, right, finish your book. So the book was actually as a result of being off work, having something to do.
Right. Okay.
But I didn't admit to the children for 2 weeks. My wife knew I was off work, but I would get dressed in the morning, get in the car the usual time. I went to the local golf club that I'm a member of.
Really?
I'm not a golfer. It's just a leisure centre.
Yeah. You just went
just ordered myself coffee, sat down and just typed for 5 or 6 hours a day.
Oh, I see.
Then came back at the normal time.
So the writing of the book helped you through the depression, then, would you say?
The reactive depression was not as a result of anything that was going on at work. The symptoms manifested themselves at work. I couldn't concentrate.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember things. I was making schoolboy errors. I couldn't understand it. And it was because the previous year I had four different line managers. And they didn't see what the decline in what normal John was.
Right.
And then when the doctor said, well, you've got depression. We're not sure which one it is. I said, well, I've a lot of things that happened. Like my eldest daughter had a road traffic accident. She was knocked off a scooter. There was all sorts of other issues that I won't bore the readers or the listeners with that were happening that were not bank related, not work related, but they just built up.
Yeah.
And the way that I describe it, it's like my hard drive had suddenly filled up and I couldn't take any more. And that's why it was sort of saying, well, no, you're not going to take that information in. You're going to have to forget that. You'll not remember this. You won't be able to recall that.
So would you say that part of your brain just kind of closed down then, did it?
I was gibbering wreck.
Couldn't remember things.
I was openly crying. I became hypersensitive.
Right.
I couldn't take criticism at all. The slightest thing would set me off. I didn't understand what was happening. And when the doctor says, this is depression, I thought, like you said at the beginning, well, I'll give me the pill and I'll be all right sort of thing.
Yeah, it's not that easy.
No, but I ignored his advice. I went back to work too soon and I didn't do the job that he suggested, which was the equivalent of stacking shelves. Because he said, look, people who are managers of superstores, you know, they have the same problem, executive stress. And the recommendation is, apart from taking a lot of time off work, is to go back and do the stacking the shelves type of job, so that you can build yourself up steadily. And I didn't do that until I moved in November. So I had this whole period from sort of March through to November where I was saying, I want to go back to work and I don't see myself as a victim. I want to be able to do the job. And my manager was trying to manage it. She didn't understand. Managers aren't trained in depression. People aren't. And it isn't something you can see.
So this was based on your own misunderstanding about what your own depression, even. Absolutely. You didn't understand your own depression. At all.
And the NHS counselling didn't kick in until September, which was a one-to-one. Sorry, it did start a kick in, I'm trying to think now, May, June, July-ish, which was a period of 8 sessions, one-to-one with a counsellor at Chorley Hospital, which was fantastic. And she was great. And it helped me address and understand certain things because often your family, my wife and the children, the worst people to try and help you out of it because they want you to get back to the way you were and can't understand
and they think
why
that's
you can't
where you should be.
Yeah. And pull yourself together. And unless you've actually gone through it, there isn't a quick fix. There isn't a pill that you can take. I mean, some people do need medication, you know, the bipolar, for example, and other forms of manic depression, which I've kind of got to know a bit more about by, when I talk about it and people talk to me and then you suddenly realize, well, you're not alone, but you do feel as though you're alone. And it wasn't until the NHS group sessions that I went to in Chorley, for a couple of hours on one afternoon each week, when I actually sat down with other people, and I suppose it's a bit like Alcoholic Anonymous, really. You suddenly start nodding, you know, who gets up in the morning and decides that they really don't want to get out of bed, you know, and can't even face making a cup of tea. And you all put your hands up and suddenly, you're looking around and thinking, well, it isn't just me. Up to that point, you always feel as though it's something that's happened to you. It's your problem. You have to deal with it. And it's not. It's like the inability if you suddenly broke your arm. People can have sympathy because they say, oh, let me help you with that because I can see you've got a broken arm. I'll help you with the shopping. You can't suddenly go in and say, look, I'm feeling a bit anxious and depressed today. How can you help me? Because
to what extent do you think our way of life, the Western way of life, contributes to that?
The Western way of life is not to admit to it because it's seen by the insurance companies and a lot of other people as an illness and something that could be generic, it could be hereditary as well. So it has a stigma attached to it.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time in physical health, don't we? And Matt Haig recently wrote a book that I went to Waterstones in Preston to hear him talk, called Reasons to Live. And it was all about his dealing with depression. And he said at the very beginning, he said, why is it that we always understand that we will never be in physical health? So why do we kid ourselves that we're over at our peak mentally? And then I made the analogy in a piece of work that I've put together for one of the internal organizations in the bank, is that you can't go to your local gym and say, do you know what? I'm quite happy doing the physical exercise, but what about the mental exercise? Because the most important muscle in the brain, in the body is my brain.
Yeah.
What have you got for that?
Yeah.
You know, well, you have your thigh bums and tums and your aerobics, but what about, can we have a session about cognitive behavior therapy? Can we have a relaxation session?
Well, perhaps the creativity, the writing, the music, the art is what exercise you can give to yourself to promote that. We'll just take a break now for another song, another tune. What have you chosen?
Well, for all the people who are writers, who may not be aware of a singer called Tom Waits, he's an American, and he champions the hobo. This piece of music called Knife and Hannapin is the story about going home on the train and what he sees. And he talks about jailhouse tattoos and donuts had the names like prostitutes. And it's just a rich cultural understanding of American journeys home on the train. And I think there's some lovely imagery in there, which if people aren't familiar with his work, I would really suggest that they check out an album like Rain Dogs. It's probably the most accessible one.
Okay, we'll have a listen to that then.
Well, it's 9th and Hennepin. All the donuts have names that sound like prostitutes. And the moon's teeth marks are on the sky like a tarp thrown all over this. And the broken umbrellas like dead birds. The steam comes out of the grill like the whole goddamn town's ready to blow. And the bricks are all scarred with jailhouse tattoos. And everyone is behaving like dogs. And the horses are coming down Violin Road and Ditch is dead on his feet. And all the rooms, they smell like diesel and you take on the dreams of the ones who've slept there. And I'm lost in the window. And I hide in the stairway, and I hang in the curtain, and I sleep in your hat. And no one brings anything small into a bar around here. They all started out with bad directions. And the girl behind the counter has a tattooed tear. One for every year he's away, she said. Such a crumbling beauty. There's nothing wrong with her. $100 won't fix. She has that razor sadness that only gets worse with the clang and the thunder of the Southern Pacific going by. And the clock ticks out like a dripping faucet until you're full of rag water, bitters, and blue ruin. And you spill out over the side to anyone who will listen. I've seen it all. I've seen it all through the yellow windows on the evening train.
Right. Well, the depression aspect of your life experience obviously led you in a particular direction. It led you to this creative side to help you cope with that, which is a very serious and important aspect. And I think there's an historical connection there, because Aristotle himself, when he first talked about writing and the benefits of writing about Greek plays and that, he talked about something called catharsis. And I've actually looked up the definition of it so that we can talk about that a little bit. He defines catharsis as the purging of the effects of a pent-up emotion and represented repressed thoughts by bringing them to the surface of consciousness. And I think what he's talking about there, to my mind, is this thing about how when we get depressed, it goes inward. We turn inward, and a lot of the stuff that we need to get out gets repressed and gets pent up inside ourselves. And I'm just thinking that the process that you went through, the writing of the book, and even now your ability to have an emotional connection with the music and with the writing of the book, helped you through that period. Would you say that's true? I know I've talked a lot there.
That is, but you've nailed it in one way, because we were saying earlier on about, almost like, it sort of dulls the savage beast, doesn't it? This is something we were saying about music does. I like to think that it's actually waking it up and also make it dance as well. But it now, looking back, having gone through that year, and being able to do presentations for What's the Story Chorley last year and the one that we all took part in this year, that to me was the symbolism that I had got to the end of this period of depression in my life, because I felt confident standing in front of people. And that was part of my job at times. And I couldn't face standing in front of people because I was nervous. I couldn't remember things. I was gibbering. So when the Digger Festival Committee asked me to do a talk to Wigan Heritage Trust, for example, along the lines of Derek's presentation, that was quite a moment for me, because that was people that I didn't know in a church who were specialists in their chosen field, which was architecture and appreciation of historical buildings. That was quite a significant watershed for me, because that was a success and another step in this journey to recovery. Because I asked the doctor, I said, how long do you think it's going to take me to recover? He said, well, how long did this build up? I said, well, you go back, it would take me 18 months. He said, well, there's your answer. So the medical people know what they're talking about. In my case, they certainly did. No, I didn't take any medication, because I'd heard all sorts of stories about that. And luckily, I didn't need to. I just needed to get more confident. Mm-hmm. So yes, writing the book and getting it published and going on that journey of publishing, self-promotion, meeting different writers, reading self-published work, which I'd never really done before. There's a whole journey that's crystallizing in being in front of you today and member of the LAA. You know, that is the journey I've been on. So, yes, the thing that Aristotle's talking about mood and how we turn in on ourselves out of that. And I think back now to that time when my mother was dying, I was going for redundancy and I was turning 40. I turned inward, but luckily something was there to say, don't, there's this explosion and this is what happened.
It's about it clearing away the pain, isn't it? About getting the pain out of our system.
Or dulling it.
Or dealing with it, you know, have to turn to
alcohol or drugs or chase women or fast cars or whatever it is.
The creative side of it.
It was the creative side that came out and it blossomed and it flourished. And, at times I wasn't. I mean, the great thing about reading the book is you don't have to be a lover of music. That's the one thing. It appeals to people who've gone through that midlife crisis, who've gone through a period of post-traumatic stress and how they've coped with it. You can now read through the spaces in between each line and think, well, that wouldn't work. Anybody could see that wouldn't work. Yeah. But he went ahead and did it. And then it proves that he was, in his day job, he was a very good business manager. Yeah. But he was a lousy manager of business. Look what happened to his limited company. My wife reminds me, you wasted £10,000 in that. You know, look on the company house register and you can see director's loan, nearly £10,000.
Yeah.
I don't see it as that because I see it as investing in the talent, in the opportunity, in the creativity, and now the manifestation of what the book is.
There's always a question of what should one spend one's money on, or what should society sort of develop, design, you know, spend its effort and its time doing. And I think the arts have always been a part of that. But it's not always about, if you're a writer, getting published or necessarily getting your stuff out there. It could be just getting it down on paper. And
I always say to people, like I used to say to bands and musicians, what is your definition of success? How will you know you'd be successful? Now, as a writer, almost like a reader in effect, is what is a successful book for you? Something that entertains, something that engages you. What poem is a success for you? All art stirs an emotion. But you either take that and say, what is success in terms of publication, in being known?
Yeah.
And I made the mistake of assuming, like a lot of people did, that a lot of artists and musicians wanted to be famous. For some, it was just a question of getting their songs heard in front of an audience, be that in Chorley Community Centre or on Chorley FM that was involved with, or just at the local pub. That may have been all. And I made the mistake of trying to push them further.
Right.
And one musician, very early on, he said, John, I don't want that. You know, that might be right for you, but I'm quite happy. But I said, you've got a great talent, you know, and the world should hear it. That's it. And some writers are like that.
Yes,
I mean, Walter James is part of our writers group in Chorley and District Writers. He's quite happy to publish stuff and let people buy it, you know, or give it away free, because it's the actual creation of the book, of the photo album, or the memory, the expression of his creativity that is sufficient. Doesn't want to make millions.
But you believe that an artist should have a goal before, before they start, should they say, I want to achieve this and this and this, or, you know, I want, I'm not saying that people should decide whether they want to be famous or not, because maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. And maybe some people aren't.
The truly talented people in history, and the people that I've met through the music business, the genius gene, as I call it, are people who understand that they make a decision between art, profit, or integrity. Artists have to survive, like everybody, but it's whether they compromise their profit, the need to make money, or their integrity, rather like the virginity. Once you give it away, you never get it back. So for an artist like Van Gogh, for example, he lived in abject poverty and created his art, and he became very, very famous afterwards and could have made loads of money because of the way his paintings sell. But he never compromises integrity. And Sean Maxwell's like that. You know, he is not a rich man. He's not made money out of 40 years of making music. He's what I call a lifer. And there are many people out there, and there are probably a lot of writers the same, who will not make a lot of money, but it's not about the money for them. Their definition of success is creativity. It's having that record. It's having that book self-published or down on piece of paper. That's sufficient for what they want. And that's where the dilemma, and that's where for people who are fans or supporters or family members or relatives, they have to understand that. It's the decision that an artist, writer, whoever, has to make themselves aware of. What is their definition of success? Why are they doing what they're doing? And when will they know that they've achieved what they've set out to achieve?
But surely some artists may have a goal to achieve X, Y, or Z, or make this money or that money, but might not achieve that, might not necessarily achieve that. And so how would you say that they need to react to that? I mean, how would you deal with rejection? How would you deal with how do you find these groups, who did want to become famous, who did want to achieve more? dealt with this issue of not being able to achieve what they wanted to achieve? Did they?
That's the chapter on Pretend Girlfriend. In a nutshell, that's the biggest chapter. It's about 80 pages long. And that will help answer your question, because you go in and you spend time with this band. At the very beginning, a lot of it is regurgitation of interviews, and you almost see them swallowing their own hype. And then you get to the conclusion where their journey comes to an end and an acceptance of the rejection.
Right.
So I wrote that chapter purposefully because I was on the road. I did the whole sex, drugs and rock and roll in that chapter to give people an insight of being involved with genius and the frustration of the rejection and sometimes success as well. I talk about the time I met Tony Wilson and gave him the CD-DVD double issue thing that we put together and thought, now we're going to be successful. And you can read what happened.
Yeah. But clearly you're driven. It seems to me that you're driven. We'll just close down in a minute. To try to promote keep promoting your book. And you haven't hit that stage where you just sort of say, oh, I can't be bothered with all of this because I'm not getting anywhere. I'm not selling enough books or whatever. Would you actually say you enjoy that promotion process, that process of getting out there, getting up in front of people saying, here, buy my book, or I'm going to tell you why my book is really great and wonderful. Do you enjoy that, or do you just kind of do it because you feel kind of like, well, I have to do this if I want people to read the book?
I'm a helper. I realize I'm a helper, and the book is all about helping people get on radio, et cetera, et cetera. Self-promotion is very important. If you produce a book and you want to tell people about it and help people share in that journey, then you have to go and promote it. And some people are good at it, some people are very poor at it, some people can do it naturally, some people can't do it. And there's a lot of tips and tips in the last chapter that will help people. And some of the workshops I run now are about helping people become confident to promote themselves.
Right.
But it goes back to, what is your definition of success? I don't want to sell millions and millions of copies. It would be nice if it happens, but it's nice to be able to join Lancashire Authors, for example, and become the secretary and take on that mantle and preserve something that is over 100 years old.
Part of a community of like-minded people.
And modernize it and retain the culture and the heritage and the great library that we've got here in Accrington. The whole problem then is that some people can't do it naturally and can't be taught it. And that's okay. That's fine. You know, but if you do need help and you want to learn some of the techniques, that is what the last chapter is about. And that is, if you take, you know, I would have loved when Waterstone said, come and do a book day. I thought, I would love to get on national radio. I'd love to get on national TV because you feel so proud of it's like a child, isn't it? Your book.
Yeah.
You know yourself with a cloven pie. It's your child. Yeah. You're proud of it. You want to share
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And the great thing about it is people can go on BBC Radio 2 website. They can click on Jo Wiley, W-H-I-L-E-Y, click on her picture when it comes up, scroll down to the clips. It's a tiny little line of 291. Then when they click on that, go to line 5, and my family are on there. There's a picture of me and my children and my wife.
Oh, that's good.
The great thing about it, though, for musicians and people who appreciate music, I am between the Foo Fighters and Bryan Adams.
Oh, great. Okay. So, we won't make any more comments about
that. And I can tell you how much
your
position is
there.
To
we won't make a political statement there on that. But okay, John, thanks very much. We've got time for one more song. Before we do that, thank you for joining us. It's been a really interesting interview, and I've enjoyed it very much. And I think you've answered a lot of questions, and we talked about kinds of things that I think are relevant and important.
I hope the listeners have enjoyed it. And of course, I'm active on the local scene, so I'll be there.
Of course, and all the best
for the future. And all the other things that we get involved with.
Of course, I look forward to working with you with Lancashire Authors, and hoping that we can get new members.
Well, and the great thing about this next choice, it really encapsulates everything that the book's about, because this is a song called Time Will Pass You By. And if I said it was by Bessie Grace Gumpton, nobody would know who she is. She's somebody who worked with some of the great American musicians back in the day as a backing singer. But if I said to you, Toby Legend, and suddenly that takes on a different meaning, because this was one of the tracks that were played in Wigan Casino before the end of every night. And it's called Time Will Pass You By Toby Legend. And she was somebody who was a nobody in terms of success, went and recorded this song, and the message is fantastic. It's a lovely song about You know, don't be a pebble on the beach. You know, don't let time pass you by. Grasp everything. And the great thing, we're talking about depression, at the end of the day, you've got to live every day to the full. And it's a great song of hope and inspiration. So,
oh, that's fantastic.
For people who don't know it and they don't know Northern Soul, you will love this song.
It's a good note to finish on. Time will pass you by.
Passing seasons all but fade away into misty clouds of autumn gray. As I sit here looking at the street, little figures quickly moving feet, I'm just a pebble. Are you happy to?